Thank you, Brother Tony, and it's kind of wonderful to be back home again. We have a very fond recall of our many years of fellowship and collaborating with the brethren here in the East, and somehow one of the things we missed most when we went to the Midwest was the brethren of the East. And so we were glad for the opportunity to come again to visit you. And first I want to bring the Christian love and greetings of the Northwest Indiana Bible students with which I meet. And also Sister Sue and Brother Alfred sent their love as well. And our text, our study today is going to be not on great things, it's going to be on little things. In view of the nature of the discussion this afternoon, we thought that that was going to be kind of heavy on prophecy, so we would take something some little things that perhaps we need to give attention to. Our discussion starts off with a text of Zechariah 4:10. For whoever has despised the day of small things shall rejoice and shall see the plummet in the hands of Zerubbabel. The thought seems to be something different than appears. It is not the despising of small things in the sense of refusing to do anything small. But rather, the thought of this text seems to be that we would disregard the smallness, disregard the insignificance, and persevere in doing it anyway. And the lesson of the text is that such who are able to disregard the smallness, who are able to disregard the insignificance and persevere in doing something, such would rejoice, and such would see the plummet in the hand of the antitypical Zerubbabel, which is Christ. Despising or disregarding the smallness is not easy to do. We all tend to love the big, the sensational, the powerful, the grandiose. These are the things that catch and hold the attention of men. The whole world is built on the concept of greatness and power, to the point where small things, the little things, tend to go unnoticed. Now, our lesson is at the time of Haggai, the time of the rebuilding of the temple. There were really three prophets that had a role to play in the rebuilding of the temple. Haggai was the prophet who prophesied about the time of Israel's return from captivity. And therefore, it was the founding work of rebuilding the temple. This founding work, we believe, in antitype started at Pentecost. The return of the Israelites found Jerusalem a shambles, with trees growing in the streets, houses were fallen and in disrepair. And it took about a year before they were able to turn their attention to building the temple at all. They had to first build themselves some kind of shelter and make provisions for their livelihood before they could start building the temple. And Haggai was the prophet who did the early work of encouraging the Israelites who had returned to start the work of building this temple. And he pictures the work of the reformers such as Wycliffe and Luther and all those throughout the age who did much to encourage the rebuilding work of the temple. Actually, the early church faced unfavorable circumstances under which to build the spiritual temple. Their leader, Christ, had been put to death. They were small in number, with few resources. But because of their great faith, the initial work prospered. But as the centuries rolled, the work was left unfinished, and the Reformation rekindled the enthusiasm of building the true temple. Zerubbabel is defined as meaning alienated from Babylon. Young defines it as a shoot from Babylon. Strong defines it as descended from Babylon, that is, born there. Zerubbabel was one of the princes among the people of the line of David, and therefore represented the kingdom hopes of the people. He represents our Lord Jesus, the prince of the house of David, whose kingdom is ultimately to be established in the whole earth. And the message given by Zerubbabel, while he was touched by Babylon, still becomes the great builder of the temple and the kingdom of the Lord. Here it is almost an irony that a shoot from Babylon should rebuild God's temple. No, the apostasy of Babylon the Great has never been able to destroy God's purpose in the building of the temple. So through the Reformation, the work of God's temple progressed, though slowly until the harvest time, the work continued. And in our time, we hope it will soon be finished. Now, we want to remember that I look at the two temples, the one that Solomon built and the one that was built by Haggai and Zechariah and Zerubbabel, finally, as two pictures, really, of the same thing. Solomon's temple, from one standpoint, shows how the temple was built from God's standpoint. You know, when Solomon built the temple, there was wealth. There was an abundance of everything. There were no shortages of anything. There was complete direction. There was power. There was excellence. There was quietness. That temple went together without the sound of a hammer. And it showed how the temple was to be erected from God's standpoint. From God's standpoint, it went on beautifully, excellently, just as God had purposed it, without the sound of a hammer, without any shortages, without any hardships. It just flowed. It was accomplished just as the Lord intended it to be. But the rebuilding of the temple, I think, shows it, the temple being built from the standpoint of the church. With all our weaknesses, with all our frailties, with all the hardships that are about us. You know, when the temple was rebuilt, there really wasn't much going for it. The people came, they were just a ragtag band of returnees from Babylon. They didn't have the artisans, they didn't have the wealth, they didn't have the disciplines, they didn't have anything that was normally required to build the temple. And so, it was a kind of a work that was done spontaneously as the direction at in each time and place was given to them. And then it was compounded by the problem that there was a mixed peoples who lived in the area about Jerusalem. For lack of a better name, we'll just call them Samaritans. And these Samaritans, when they saw the temple designs and the plans to rebuild the temple, oddly enough, they didn't oppose it. They wanted to join it. They wanted to help the Israelites. They wanted to befriend them. They wanted to have a part in this temple that they were rebuilding. Well, what's wrong with that? It seems almost kind of nice to have people help you building the temple. It's they really needed all the help they could get. It seems so anyway. They didn't have hardly anything going for them in the rebuilding of this temple. It was under the most strict and austere conditions that the temple was to be rebuilt. And how easy it would have been for them to say, well, now isn't this the providence of the Lord. Here these good neighbors of ours must have been moved by the Lord to come and help us rebuild the temple. That would be the easy construction to put upon this proffered assistance from the good Samaritans, as it were, that lived about Jerusalem. But, no, they did not accept the help from the Samaritans. They refused this help. They said, no, you may not help us build the temple. Thank you, but no thanks. We don't want you to join us in the building of the temple. And that didn't set very well with the Samaritans. They became those who were at the outset had befriended the Israelites were now hostile and antagonistic to them. And it may seem maybe later that some of them had wished that they had allowed them to help. They could have rationalized and said, well, if we'd have let them help us, it would only be a little while and they'd quit working and we wouldn't have incurred their opposition. We wouldn't have incurred their hostility. You know, it's easy to rationalize. But dear friends, the decision to say no to these Samaritans, to tell them we do not and we cannot have you help us build this temple, was the correct decision to make. It was a case of principled carefulness. We cannot expect the world or the nominal church or sources from the nominal systems to help in building the temple of God. At times they may proffer their assistance. Now, what would be some practical applications of how this might happen in the outworking of the church's experience? How might the world and the church about us say, we'll help you. We'll help you to build the temple of God. Well, first off, we better beware when the world or the nominal systems begin to offer their assistance. You know, one of these things that we learn from history is that we were always able to deal with the enemy when he was on the outside. But when the enemy gets on the inside, then the church's defenses usually fell apart. That's where the Lord's people suffered the most, is when they allowed the enemy to be absorbed into their midst, and then they could not deal effectively with the enemy. Now, how might this happen among the Lord's people today? You know, we can all buy the idea that, well, back there, that was the right thing. But bringing it up today, how might we find a practical application for this? Well, as we look about us, we see that there are many areas in which the world has offered assistance. For instance, if you were studying for the ministry today, one of the major courses that you would have to take is in psychology. You couldn't be a minister today. That is one that has a sheepskin, a diploma from any of the theological seminaries, unless you had showed that you matriculated in the subject of psychology. Here again we see that the world influence has affected the church. Now, one of the things we notice in the early church, particularly with the writings of Apostle Paul, if you'll turn to 1 Corinthians, the second chapter, you'll see how the Apostle Paul did not allow the worldly wisdom, the philosophy of his time and his place to affect his writings and his teachings to the church. In 1 Corinthians, the second chapter, he says, "When I came to you, brethren," and this is the first verse, "I did not come proclaiming to you, I did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God in lofty words of wisdom." In other words, I didn't come to you with words of wisdom from this world, with all their lofty sentiments, with all their beautiful philosophies that he could have picked out a little bit of the philosophy from the Greeks and the Romans, and he could have intertwined this into the gospel of Christ. But he did not. He would not. He would not allow this any partnership in the gospel of Christ. He says, "For I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I was with you in weakness and in much fear and trembling, and my speech and my message were not in the plausible words of wisdom." That is the wisdom of man. He avoided this. He avoided it like a plague in the writing of the words of the gospel. "But in demonstration of spirit and power, that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. Yet among the mature we do impart wisdom, although it is not the wisdom of this age or the rulers of this age who are doomed to pass away." Oh, dear friends, any time we allow the wisdom of this age to come into the church, we are opening the doors to the enemy. We're saying, "Help us build the church." You know, it's so easy to go out and to pick a good book from some minister, and they have a lot of nice thoughts in the Christian life, and to pick this up and use this as the basis of a sermon. But again, we do not think we should do this. We should not go out into the nominal church where we believe they are unfaithful in their serving of the Lord and expect to bring such wisdom into the church to help build the church. And there are other ways. I think that in our time and place, the wisdom of the world sometimes creeps into the church. And we see this happening along various lines, but particularly I'm thinking in terms of, should we follow the ways of the world? Now, in the world, you see, they have been troubled with immorality, and they've been troubled with the breaking down of the institutions of marriage, and so they counter it with another front, and they'll come up with the idea of marriage encounter. And it's so easy for us to bring this into the church, to help our marriage, to make it a more splendid thing. But dear friends, the moment we do this, we're doing the same thing as the Israelites would have done if they had allowed the Samaritans to come and help them build the temple. No, we must keep the enemy on the outside. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't some beautiful things in the world. It doesn't mean that in all the worldly philosophies there aren't noble thoughts, beautiful thoughts. There certainly are a lot of wonderful and beautiful things in the world that we could latch onto. But we must not bring these for food into the church. The moment we do, we're allowing the influences of the nominal systems and of the world and the wisdom of this world to come in and to have a partnership in the building of the temple of Christ. All right, that's one aspect. Now, there's another aspect. You know, we go back to the time of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. In Numbers 16, 9, and 10. One One aspect of small things is the fact that sometimes very significant and honorable things that the Lord has given us to do are often not received as such. In the quest for still greater things, it becomes possible to forget that the Lord has done great things for us, far more than we deserve. He's bestowed upon us abundant honors. And yet, sometimes, we find ourselves in the position of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram when the Lord said this to them. He says, "Is it too small a thing for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the service of the tabernacle of the Lord?" Now, is that too small a thing? Is that too small a thing that the Lord has done for you? And that he has brought you near to him, and all your brethren, the sons of Levi, with you. And would you seek the priesthood also? Would you seek something more than what the Lord has done for you? Is this too small, the portion that I have given you? Apparently it was. Apparently what the Lord had done for them, he had done them a great honor. He had blessed them. He had given them a service and a privilege which was high above the rest of the household of Israel. They had the opportunity of coming near to the Lord, to serve him in his tabernacle. But that wasn't enough. It was a small thing that the Lord had done for them. Too small. And they wanted something more. And that led them to their demise. Dear friends, how often we have to look into our own hearts when we feel maybe discouraged and despondent with our lot and ask ourselves, is it a small thing that the Lord has done for us? Is it too small a thing that he has done for us? Oh, he has taken us out of the horrible pit and the miry clay, and he's brought us near to himself. Would we seek something more than the portion that he has given us? Then there's another lesson that we have. This is in Numbers, the 12th chapter. This is just a little family. It starts out with just a little family quarrel. I think we're all familiar with family quarrels. This was a case of Miriam and Aaron. And apparently, as we read, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married. For he had married a Cushite woman. Apparently, Miriam started the dissent. And she apparently was a good sister to Moses, a more dedicated and a more wonderful sister a brother could not ask for than Miriam. She had been faithful to Moses and had apparently been a great power and factor in his life. It was Miriam, remember, who had been used of the Lord to help save Moses' life. She stood near the little ark that they had in the bulrushes, and she it was that the Lord had used to keep the family continuity. She secured for Moses his own mother as his nurse. And she apparently was also had access to Moses during his early childhood. And she apparently had become a very dear and precious sister to him. So much so that between his mother and his sister, he was greatly influenced in his appreciation of the promises to Abraham. Matter of fact, Jochebed and Miriam apparently lit a fire in Moses' life that all the glory and beauty of Egypt could not extinguish. And this possessed Moses, and he was enamored with the promises to Abraham, and he was willing to to lay aside all the glory of Egypt, to cast his lot in with the people of God. And yet, at this occasion, when Moses had married the Cushite woman, apparently a little rivalry, a little jealousy worked its way into the heart of Miriam. And she thought that, well, now, having married this Cushite woman, that she would be kind of less influential in the affairs of Israel and less influential with her brother. She would have less access to Moses than she had before. And so there was a little bit of antagonism here. And so they said, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?" They did the same thing that Korah, Dathan, and Abiram did, only it was on another plane. They were not hostile to Moses. They were just a little jealous of Moses' wife. And it led them to this extreme. Now, this is just a little family matter, and it could have stopped there. But it doesn't. Now, Moses, we are told, was very meek, more than all men that were on the face of the earth. And suddenly, the Lord said to Moses and to Aaron and to Miriam, "Come out. Come out, you three, to the tent of the meeting." And the three of them came out. And the Lord came down on the pillar of the cloud, and he stood at the door of the tent, and he called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forward. And then the Lord began to reason with these two. And notice his approach to them. He said, "If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. But not so with my servant Moses. He is entrusted with all my house. With him, I speak mouth to mouth, clearly, and not in dark speech. And he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? Have you no fear of me? Have you no reverence for me? Don't you understand by disregarding Moses, you are disregarding the God of Moses? I don't speak to him like other prophets and other holy men of the past. I have spoken to him face to face, as one man speaks to another. He has seen the very form of the Lord. Have you no reverence for my dealing with Moses? I could expect this from the enemies of Israel. But you, Miriam, and you, Aaron, I could not expect this from you." And the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, and he departed. And when the cloud removed from over the tent, behold, Miriam was leprous, as white as snow. And Aaron turned towards Miriam, and behold, she was leprous. And Aaron said to Moses, "Oh, my Lord, do not punish us because we have done foolishly and have sinned. Let her not be as one dead of whom the flesh is half consumed when he comes out of his mother's womb." And Moses cried to the Lord, "Heal her, O God, I beseech thee." But the Lord said to Moses, and notice he wasn't going to placate his anger so quickly. The Lord was angry, and he had reason to be angry because she failed to recognize the holiness, the anointing of the Lord that was upon Moses. From the very Spirit of the Lord was upon him. And he said, but the Lord said to Moses, "If her father had but spit in her face, should she not be shamed for 7 days? Let her be shut up outside the camp 7 days, and after that she may be brought in again." And so Miriam was shut up outside the camp for 7 days, and the people did not set out on the march until Miriam was brought in again. And so from this little family quarrel, we see how the Lord intervened. But we see that there was a lack of reverence for the Lord. It was the mere fact that he was their brother that allowed them to murmur against him. They took liberties against him because they were so close to him. After all, Moses was only her brother. She had helped bring him up in many ways. And so she began to treat him as just a brother, when in fact, while he was a brother, he was more than a brother. He was one of the Lord's holy vessels. And they failed to take recognition of this very fact. And I think in our time and place, sometimes we hear the same thing that's happening. We hear the idea that, well, we want open Bible study. We want to go and behold the word of the Lord, and the Lord will lead us into the truth just like he led others. But dear friends, that's not the way the Lord deals. The Lord never dealt that way with anyone. He has always dealt through his appointed leaders to the church. And for us to disregard these leaders is to incur the Lord's displeasure. In Revelation, we learn that there are seven messengers. These seven messengers are held where? They're held in the Lord's right hand. We cannot disregard these messengers with impunity, without disregarding the Lord himself. You know, if you had a job and the assistant to the boss came out to you and said, well, now, this is the way we'd like things to be done here today, and would you please begin to do it this way? I think most of us would do it that way. We wouldn't say, well, who are you? You are only the assistant from the boss. If the boss wants this done, let him come himself and tell me directly what he wants done. I'm sure if we took that attitude, we'd be standing outside the building with our pay for the day, and that would be the end of the matter. No, we cannot disregard those whom the Lord is working through with impunity. And so here's a lesson as well. The Lord has chosen to speak to us through various prophets of the past. He has spoken through us through his own dear Son, and his dear Son has given gifts to the church, and these we may not disregard without suffering the consequences. Well, some other matters. What about motherhood and the woman's role? If you read the prevailing writings on the woman's movement, there seems to be a lot of dissatisfaction on the part of women with their lot in life. And not only is there dissatisfaction, but there is a strong movement to change all of this. We're going to end it. The woman's movement is going to just change the shape of the world, and they're going to bring about a world in which men and women share equally in all the experiences of life. No longer must the woman be limited by the house and the home and by children. We are told that she must be free to become great in the world and in world affairs. She must be able to get into business and commerce and politics. The stigma of being a wife and a mother and a homemaker must be quickly erased. Oh, not that these things are bad, they say, but women must ascend into the real world and share in the accomplishments that make people great and renowned. They must become bank presidents. They must become corporate executives. You see, they really should amount to something. Well, I do not want to jump into this fray and argue for or against what women should or shouldn't be doing. But I wonder if people aren't being misled by movement thinking In the first place, I don't trust movements too much. Movements are never as altruistic as they seem to be. Usually, movements are led by leaders who want to get to a certain place, and they will use people freely to get to the place where they want to go, and they will sacrifice as many people as necessary to get to the place where they want to go. And when they get there, they are not beholding to the people by whom they got there. Movements tend to exploit people, even though they oftentimes have certain idealisms that are high-sounding and at times sound beautiful. First off, I'd like to say that in Ezekiel 18:25, the Lord said, "Are not my ways equal? Are not your ways unequal?" God's ways are equal. They always are. And for a woman's role, haven't they been called upon to bear the burden of procreation? And the answer is yes, of course. Haven't they suffered and sacrificed more in the great purpose of God to fill the earth? Of course they have. They have carried the burden of this great and this glorious assignment to fill the earth. Now I want to ask a question. 2,000 years from now, who is going to remember much about who was the president of what bank? Who was the top executive of IBM or General Motors or what have you? Who is going to remember all these seemingly impressive roles that people have in the world today? Today, you know, men wear their glory on a sign above their office or on their desk. But in the kingdom time, they're going to wear the glory in their very being, in their character, and in their hearts. Men and women are not going to be very much impressed with who was president of General Electric or IBM. Matter of fact, maybe some of those that were executives in these great corporations might be a little bit ashamed. Who's going to care about these roles? But you know, people are different. You know, when the mother is caring for a child, from one standpoint, she's dealing with eternity. Children, people, are forever. For the most part. Some of them may not last forever, but for the most part, when you're dealing with human beings, you're dealing with eternity, because human beings play a part in God's eternal purpose. God has designed that man is going to live upon this earth. He's going to be crowned with glory and honor and a beautiful kingdom here on earth. And so those who are dealing with children are dealing with eternity. And how much greater fulfillment, I think, in the kingdom time, woman's role is going to be a lot more appreciated than it has been during the 6,000 years of the past. There's little doubt that women have suffered and have been exploited in this process of procreation, and they've had to endure and suffer more. But God's ways are equal. And in the outworking of his purpose in the kingdom time, if they have borne a greater burden, so in the kingdom time they shall share a greater blessing and a greater honor, because, in fact, their hands have been dealing with eternity in dealing with the great commission of filling the earth. And so sometimes we have to step apart from the world's thinking and look at it from God's standpoint for a moment. And there's little doubt when we look at it from the standpoint of eternity that there is very little greater that men is going to do today and women than to procreate. That is, we're talking about it from a human standpoint, not from the standpoint of the new creation. But there's nothing greater than they will do than to be able to raise their family in honor and dignity and give them the values that will last for eternity. If they have done that, eternity will pass a kind judgment an appreciation on their work in this present time. All right, then we want to talk about the lesser part. The Lord deals differently with His people, and sometimes it's good to look at how He deals the differences. Let's contrast Moses and John the Baptist. Both of them, truly great people. Moses was used in a very special way. He was a lawgiver. He was a statesman. He was a prophet. He was a ruler. He was a judge. He spoke to God face to face. He had a radiant countenance to prove it. He had a veil over his face because his glory was so great at times that it frightened the children of Israel. He didn't have to tell them, "Do you know that I spoke to the Lord face to face?" It was obvious. His face shone, so it frightened others. He had a dramatic evidence of God's dealings in his life. He wrote laws. Laws so great, so profound, that the whole world has been enamored with these laws. He also died in a unique way. He was taken up into the mountain, and he was put to sleep by the mouth, or really, literally, I think it's the kiss of the Lord. It's just like a goodnight kiss that the Lord gave to Moses when he put him to sleep up in the mountain. Well, you can't have a more majestic role than you find in the life of Moses. He was touched with glory and beauty and excellence in so many ways that it's just majestic to see how the Lord used this great and this powerful figure. All right, let's contrast John the Baptist. We know from Jesus' own words, he paid this man the highest compliment that could be paid. He said, "Of those born of women, there is not a greater than John." And yet, the Lord dealt so differently with John. He was called to salvage and recover the children of Moses from their backsliding. John wrote no laws. He made no tabernacle. He did not speak with God face to face. He had no legal office. He had no office except the own credentials that he was a prophet of the Lord. He made no tabernacle. He had no rod to perform miracles with. He performed no miracles that we know of. He had no Urim, no Thummim. No vestments of priestly office. He didn't even have very fine vestments by the standards of his day. He was dressed in the crudest of garments, in camel's hair, just a camel skin over his body. That was his clothing. Where did he live? He didn't live in a palace. He didn't live in the city. He lived in the wilderness. From his childhood, almost, he was separated from the normal duties of life, and he was called out into the wilderness where the Lord undertook his own education personally. John the Baptist was instructed and taught by the Holy Spirit very much the way the Apostle Paul was instructed when he was accepted as a member of the church. He was separated by the power of God, and no human agency had to do with his development and his nurturing in the understanding of the Word of God, except superficially in his very early childhood. But the Lord assumed complete control of John's life, and yet John's life was so bland, was so unsensational. And then Moses, you remember, led the people of Israel for 40 years, and he had 120 years that just packed full of almost excitement in the Lord's dealings with him. But John was martyred in his 30s. He was a young man when he died. He wasn't even visited by the Son of God. You know, Jesus upbraids the goat class. He says, "I was in prison and ye visited me not." And when John was in prison, Our Lord visited him not. He wasn't even visited by the Son of God. None greater than John. So we see that the Lord has different ways of dealing with different ones. And one of the lessons we learn from John's life was his willingness to accept the lesser part. He said, "He that hath the bride is the bridegroom. But the friend of the bridegroom rejoices greatly to hear the bridegroom's voice. And this my joy is full, because nothing can be given a man except it be given him of God." And so whatever portion the Lord gave him, he was rejoicing in it. He was fulfilled in it. And that is the secret of his greatness. John was great in taking the lesser part. That's one of the hardest tests of greatness, is to be great in taking a lesser part. Well, we'll press on here. Another little account is in 1 Kings, the 14th chapter and the 13th verse. You know, we don't often in the Bible get what God thinks about people. He doesn't confide in us very often. Once in a while, he'll, like he did with Miriam, he'll remind them of just what he thought about Moses. But we don't often hear what he thinks about people or what he thinks about children. But the account of 1 Kings 14 is a little story, one of the little stories of the Bible that's seemingly insignificant. But there you remember Jeroboam had a son named Abijah, and this little son became very ill. And Jeroboam wasn't on very good terms with the Lord's prophet Ahijah, and so he didn't feel free to go to Ahijah and talk to him about his son. So he thought he would do a little scheming, and he would find out from the Lord anyway what he wanted to know. He thought he would just send his wife disguised to the prophet and inquire about this child, and that the prophet would give him the information, and he wouldn't be reproached by the prophet in any way. Particularly, the prophet was old, and he was kind of probably had cataracts, and he was couldn't see too well, and it seemed like this little ruse was going to work. And so he sent his wife, and she comes to the prophet, and the prophet is, of course, is forewarned by the Holy Spirit that this is Jeroboam's wife. And no sooner did she appear than he invited her in, and he told her who she was, which must have frightened her a bit. And then he laid upon her heavy tidings that the Lord was sending to Jeroboam. Death was decreed for all of Jeroboam's sons, every one of them. And the prophet Ahijah told this poor mother that as soon as her feet touched the city that she had come from, that her little son, Abijah, who was ill, would die. Well, so much for that, but in this little account in 1 Kings 14:13, we read about God's own feelings in this matter. And we don't often find him confiding this. This is what makes it kind of a unique little story. He says that all Israel shall mourn for him and bury him, that is this young boy, for he only of Jeroboam shall come to the grave, because in him there is something pleasing to the Lord. Oh, there was something pleasing to the Lord about this young boy, this sick young boy. He pleased the Lord. Now, it didn't lift the Lord's judgment against Jeroboam's house, but it made the Lord a little pitiful, a little sorry that he had to execute this judgment against this boy who apparently had some very lovely qualities of heart and mind. And we see here how extravagantly interested the Lord is in these beautiful heart qualities. Whether they're in a child or in an adult, we see that the Lord is interested in the heart qualities of people, no matter what their age. It starts off as little children. But here the Lord confides his feelings toward a little boy. When we press on, we come to our next story. This is about Lot. Remember Lot. He himself was a righteous man, but he lived in an unrighteous city. It's contrast, isn't it? He was vexed every day what he saw go on there, but it never occurred to Lot to pack up and leave. That was too much for his frail strength and his way of thinking. He was comfortable in Sodom, and he couldn't think in terms of leaving. And finally, when the day came that the two angels came, we are told that Lot lingered. So the men seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, and the Lord being merciful to him, they brought him forth and set him outside the city. Then, in Genesis 19:16 and 17, they gave Lot specific instructions. They said, as soon as they brought Lot out of the city, they told him, "Flee for your life. Do not look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Flee to the hills, lest you be consumed." Go right directly to the hills. But no sooner had the angels spoken to Lot, and we find, to their surprise and chagrin, that Lot is contradicting them. They had delivered to him the very word of the Lord. And he says, "Oh no, my lords, behold your servant that found favor in your sight, and you have shown me great kindness in saving my life, but I cannot flee to the hills, lest the disaster overtake me and I die. Behold, yonder city is near enough to flee to, and it is a little one. Let me escape there." And then looking at the angel, apparently the angels must have been quite surprised at his boldness, he said, "Is it not a little one?" You know, the angels must have been quite shocked at Lot's response. In heaven, when the Lord says, "Go," the angels go. When he says, "Come," they come. And when he says, "Stay," they stay. No one says, "Oh, no, Lord." And here, the boldness of Lot. He'd been given the very word of the Lord. And he says, "Oh, no, my lords. I cannot go to the mountain. That's too much. Let me go to the city. It's a little city." It is a little city, isn't it? Well, I think that portrays maybe the attitude of the great company. They don't have a reverence for the word of the Lord. Contrast this with Abraham. Now, we see that the human heart is deceitful above all things. But we see that when Abraham was told to go 3 days' journey into the mountain, and not only that, he was told to do something that was really abominable in his own eyes. He was told to go and offer his very son in sacrifice. Abraham said nary a word. You notice how Abraham overcame in this trial? Did he call in his household and Sarah and everyone there and said, "Now, this is what the Lord has required of me, and I want you all to share this experience"? He did not. Quietly, Abraham took his journey to the mountain. He confided in no one. Absolutely no one. He bore that burden for 3 days all the way to Mount Moriah, except maybe to the Lord. And he reasoned with the Lord. that possibly in view of this request that the Lord had something grander. Even though he got no answer, there's no indication that the Lord said, well, you slay your son Isaac and we'll raise him from the dead. He wasn't given that assurance. He wasn't told anything like that. That was only his own reasonings of faith. But the Lord gave him a commission, a difficult, impossible almost commission, and yet Abraham moved to fulfill it, never lifting a doubt in his mind. Now, 3 days he bore this burden, but Lot could not bear his assignment for 3 minutes. He was told to go to the hills, and he demurred almost instantly. Therein, dear friends, is the difference in character. Abraham was an overcomer. Lot maybe overcame in the end, but he wasn't disciplined to act upon the very word of the Lord, was he? And if we want to be among the overcomers, we have to have such discipline. One of the last points is on yielding. We'll have to just breeze through this quickly. Our time is up. But one of the great lessons of the Christian life is learning to yield. And that's hard to do. We all like to win. We all like to be on top and to have our wills fulfilled in some ways. But yielding is a difficult thing. But one of the experiences that we have is in Acts, the 18th chapter. It's the story of Paul's coming to Jerusalem. And he had brought some of the friends, the brethren from Caesarea with him. And it was a grand occasion when the great Apostle Paul came to Jerusalem with all his wonderful tales of how the Lord had worked through him and the establishing of the churches and how the Lord had blessed his ministry in the world at that time. Well, they rejoiced for a short time in what Paul had to tell them, but they didn't listen too long to Paul's report. They had more important matters that they wanted to confront Paul with. And so they immediately got to the point. They said, now, Paul, we have a lot of Jews in this community that they hear that you are against the law. And we're a little bit troubled. Your presence here isn't going to make it too easy for us with these brethren. We were hopeful of getting them to accept the truth. And now your presence among us here is going to raise some eyebrows with these Jews. We better move to placate some of these Jews. We don't want to offend them, and we don't want to lose them as possible members of the body of Christ. So we've got a plan for you. You've come here now, and you're a Jew. Why don't you take these four Jewish brethren here that are going into the temple to perform the rites of purification? You go into the temple, and you have the rites of purification, and then we'll be able to show all these Jewish people that, well, the Apostle Paul, he's not against the law. See, he's right in there in the temple, and he's performing the rites of purification, and that'll kind of take us all off the hook, and there'll be the ministry will go on unhindered. Well, that's just what the Apostle Paul needed. He had come from a long and tired trip to meet with the brethren and to share the joys of the Lord with them, and here they were hustling him off to the temple to be separated from the brethren and to be in the Jewish temple to perform the rites of purification. But the Apostle Paul yielded. All right, if that's what you want, I'll go along with it. He doesn't even tell us how he thought about it. I'm sure he wasn't overjoyed, but that's what the brethren feel. That's what we'll do. So he yielded. But then the mystery, the plot thickens, because it doesn't work the way the brethren thought it was going to work. It backfired. the Jews found Paul in the temple, and they thought he had brought some Gentiles into the temple, and it created an uproar. And do you know that from that day and forward, Paul was in bonds and in imprisonment? He yielded to the counsel of the brethren, and from that day and forward, he was in prison and in bonds. And the rest of his life, he's traveling from one court to another, and finally he gets to Rome. And according to tradition, he was vindicated on the charges against him, but he arrived in Rome about the time of Nero's persecution, and he was a Christian, and it's alleged that Nero set fire to the city, and he was the culprit that was to be blamed for the trouble, so he quickly blamed the Christians for it, and the Christians were... there was a great persecution of the Christians in Rome, not in the rest of the world, but in the vicinity where it would take Nero off the hook. And the Christians were rounded up and they were burnt in the public square, but Paul was a Roman citizen and he was beheaded. But now the point is here, there's never any murmur on the Apostle Paul's part to say, well, now you brethren, you really fixed me up, but he could have said that, and that's in a sense what happened. But he knew that this was in the providence of the Lord, and there was never any resentment that this had befallen him. Well, we must conclude, and in conclusion, we'd like to just leave this poem with you, The Secret of the Saints. To play through life a perfect part, unnoticed and unknown, to seek no rest in any heart, save only God alone. In little things, to own no will, to have no share in great, to find the labor ready still, and for the crown to wait. Upon the brow to bear...